achieve technology. So they are able to look up the web, they're able to do their banking, they're able to, you know, do their resumes and send emails. And it's they have what they call e-hubs. They've set up at least three of them in that community. I think there's one at Pippi Beach and one at McLean. And so
Pippi Beach, that's Yamba.
Yamba, around that area, And so what it means is that it's great, actually. I've been down there a couple of times, and you'll see the elders with young people showing them how to use the computers. There's homework classes, and the elders come in and, you know, they do their work, and they're relating their stories back onto their web page. So, you know, they're being really involved in the technology themselves. So this is something that we really are keen to push out further into the community.
Because what's happening a lot from my observations are the young ones are accessing these resources at schools and are quite skillful. I mean, a couple of granddaughters are 7-year-old. And the way they can sit down and track their way through a computer and around the computer and do all the different things that they do is just amazing. So what I'm saying is the young ones are certainly into it at school, but the older ones, the older family. My guest is Rhonda Appo. Rhonda is a manager of The Indigenous Engagement Project. It's a project funded by DEST in Canberra, Department of Education, Science and Training. It's part of the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. And it's about getting Indigenous people and technology, getting Indigenous people into the technology side of things. Rhonda, welcome to the program. How are you this morning?
I'm good, thanks, Tiger. Thank you for asking me to come today.
Yeah, it's good to have you in. Now, tell us, Blackfellas and technology. There's government is focusing on encouraging, assisting Indigenous people work more with modern technology. And how do you define technology in your position?
Definitely. Tiger, I'm funded by the Australian Flexible Learning Framework that is managed by DEST. And it's an initiative that's been going for a couple of years now, but it looks at trying to increase access to education training through e-learning. Now, I guess we can talk about e-learning as the use of the web, CD-ROMs, computer-based learning resources in the classroom, in the workplace or at home. You can learn online and you can do your course activities and group discussions and online assessment and activities. But what it has, the last 2 years has been focusing mainly on the client, and one of the major clients is the Indigenous community, and that's where I come in, looking at trying to embed e-learning and trying to get Murrays looking at technology and how they can use it to their advantage, I guess, and be up to date with the rest of the community.
So is there enough resources in communities? I mean, Do more Indigenous families have computers and access to internet and broadband and all this other business in homes, or is it largely Aboriginal organisations? Whether we're talking about Brisbane or Cape York, I mean, there's got to be a difference here. Cape York,
there is a difference. Mm. And when we talk about urban people and provincial people and remote and very remote, this project has been an absolute eye-opener for me, because in the very remote areas, some of the technology is the high end. And then sometimes we look at, you know, the inner suburbs of Brisbane, and we'll find out that there's hardly any computer ownership at all. So, yes, there is a struggle to have everyone on an equal footing. So what we're trying to do is get strategies around this, I guess, to try and include everybody, which is, you know, a difficult ask in itself. Some of the projects that we've funded are really talking about partnerships, and they've been successful in getting partnerships with community organisations, industry and enterprises and government, and they've been highly successful. so far. I can give you an instance.
What are some of the successes with projects?
Last year we funded a project down the New South Wales North Coast, and we're really talking about how do we engage Indigenous people in accepting the technology and using the technology for their own, you know, for their own devices, and to bring them up to a level where they can compete in the technological age. The project down in the New South Wales North Coast is really interesting in that out-of-date computers, or computers that aren't used by the big companies anymore, say Westpac or Commonwealth Bank, etc., are sourced by a group on the New South Wales North Coast. They re-image them, they get Murray people to go through them and take all the software off and put all the new software in, and then they put it out to community for a low cost, around about $200 or $250. And what it means is that people on those communities there have access to technology. So they are able to look up the web, they're able to do their banking, they're able to, you know, do their resumes and send emails. And it's they have what they call e-hubs. They've set up at least three of them in that community. I think there's one at Pippi Beach and one at McLean. And so
Pippi Beach, that's Yamba.
Yamba, around that area, yeah. Mm. And so what it means is that It's great, actually. I've been down there a couple of times, and you'll see the elders with young people showing them how to use the computers. There's homework classes, and the elders come in, and you know, they do their work, and they're relating their stories back onto their web page. So you know, they're being really involved in the technology themselves. So this is something that we really are keen to push out further into the community.
Because what's happening a lot from my observations are the young ones are accessing these resources at schools and are quite skillful. I mean, a couple of granddaughters are 7-year-old. And the way they can sit down and track their way through a computer and around the computer and do all the different things that they do is just amazing. So what I'm saying is the young ones are certainly into it at school, but the older ones, the older family members, the parents and the older members of the community, have difficulty in accessing resources. So is there anything like this happening in Queensland, you think, where Indigenous people might be able to distribute, anybody distributing computers?
No, I don't know anywhere in Queensland so far, but I'm going down there tomorrow and to have a talk to them. They've got very good linkages with places like Microsoft, and so I'm going to go down tomorrow and we'll talk about how we can push it out further into the community. I know that there are places, there's Use Enterprises down in Sydney that also do the same sort of thing. So, but it's very heartening to see that, you know, Murray people will have access to technology. And so on.
And Rhonda's working with Australian Flexible Learning and trying to link up more Indigenous people with technology. And it's mostly computers, internet and e-learning and stuff, Rhonda, is it not?
That's exactly right. And also the other resources with CD-ROMs and, online learning.
Now, there is CD-ROMs, again, there is some value and a real application here for this type of technology, recording oral histories and what have you. But what are some of the incentives, some of the other, how can they be used in a home on a personal level?
I'll just give you an instance. I've just been up to Cairns the last couple of weeks, and we were looking at a project that we're funding up there, and it is trying to increase the capacity of small tourism operators in the northern end. And there's especially one person from the, I'm sure you won't mind me mentioning him, Willie Broom from up at Jabakai Tours. And what they're doing is putting their digital stories, they're developing their own digital stories to be put onto the web to show people about their businesses. And there's another fellow, Cassie Gutchen from up at Coranda. He's got a small cottage industry with coconut oil. So he's putting his digital story up there to promote his business. And they're all bringing them all together as a network. They're talking to each other on a program called Skype, which is a free internet-based program that you can talk to each other just like a telephone. So if you get to know all these programs that are out there and that are free, you know, you certainly be able to cut down on your telephone costs, of course, and you can link in with each other. So it's about using those resources that are on the web that can put people in contact with other people in another community or your friends and family, you know, that aren't with you. So it's about bringing people together and, you know, the tyranny of distance, I guess, is probably, you know, what we all dislike in some way, but it's about bringing people together too. I can see it as you know, a great... another way of bringing people together.
Yeah, yeah. Just communicating, staying in touch.
Communicating and staying in touch, for sure.
Because there's that old saying in the Murray community, the only time we ever get together is funerals and weddings.
No good.
I don't know, Tim, there's no weddings in my family. My daughter's a bit too smart for that. But funerals we certainly get together for. And So this is certainly something that can keep people in touch with each other. What types of projects or what types of projects do you consider for grants? Who? Do they need to be community organisations? What's the story?
Look, I guess that this project here, we really needed to show... It was very difficult to see what was out there in the Indigenous community. And we had no idea in the very first beginning, when we first started out. When we did a bit of a scan of everything, we found that there were just pockets of people that had technology, that used it, but there was certain levels of misconception and, you know, not being used to its advantage. So we tried to fund projects that built on the successes, and there's been heaps of successes out there. We have funded another project called e-governance, and that's running out of Dubbo. And we're really looking at projects that span a couple of states so that we can get good value from our dollars, I guess. This project is really quite significant in that it looks at e-governance, and I know that lots of communities are looking at ways that they can be more involved in, you know, doing the right thing by their community groups. So at the end of this year, you will have probably three components or three modules that will be able to be accessed free to your community if you'd like them, about governance for your community. I think one is with elders, one is with governments and so on, and one's with community groups. So these people from Dubbo in New South Wales, they're developing these resources and see if it works. So at the end of the year, we hope to be able to have that out to those communities that want to be involved.
I bumped into two blokes in the Burke Bowling Club last Wednesday night. Cecil C. Talking about this governance. Rod Towney and Cecil
Rod
C.
Rod Towney actually
blokes
is...
Blokes that I've known for the last 20 years or more, 25 years.
Is the project
years.
Manager, would you believe?
Right, yeah. And they were telling us briefly, and my ears were certainly opened up and pricked up. And I thought, this is fantastic, because we do need to improve our governance issues in community, and this certainly sounds good. How can people contact you or somebody if they want to follow this up? If they're listening to this and they're saying, I want to follow this up, how can they?
Well, certainly you can email me and I'll give you my email address. It's Rhonda, R-H-O-N-D-A, dot Appo, A-P-P-O, at, that's a little squiggly sign, at debt, D-E-T, dot Q-L-D, dot gov, G-O-V, dot A-U. But just to let you know also...
Is there any 1300 numbers or phone numbers?
1300, no.
Email's the best. But what about the people that don't have email access to computers?
Yes, that's exactly right. We will be getting it out. We'll be doing some publicity through your program, of course, and you'll be able to hear grabs from our project managers throughout Australia. We'll be also advertising in the Koori Mail and in the National Indigenous Times. We're running a national forum at the end of the year on the 5th of December here in Brisbane, and you'll be able to hear all the project outcomes. Certainly I'll be able to talk to you about that, but we will be advertising it and promoting it through the Murray Grapevine, of course.
And the Murray Indigenous, the Indigenous Media Network, the Murray Media Network. So stay tuned to your local station and you should hear more of this. Rhonda, we're about out of time. Is there anything you want to... first up, Tell us your country, your mob, your clan group or groups you belong to.
I'm from Mamu people, and so is my husband, Neil. So,
and whereabouts is that?
They're
for the benefit
up in Innisfail, around that way,
Okay. All right. Any points you want to wind up on?
No, but I just wish everyone the best in their projects and keep an ear out for our teams that will be talking in throughout the year from now until February. Thanks, Tiger, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for coming in. And I think it's just fantastic that we've got the opportunities to follow up with projects like you're able to fund under the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. I've got Steve Hagan that's going to join me right about now. Steve, how are you going there, mate?
Good, thanks, Tiger. And yourself?
Yes, going well, going well. Steve, tell us your country, your mob, your clan group or groups you belong to.
Yes, my father's father is a Cuddly man from southwest Queensland, and his mother is a Mudigan lady. My mother's father is a Kuma man near St George Bolland, and her mother is a Goongri lady from Mitchell area. So I cover quite a large area in southwest Queensland.
All right. And your current role up there at the uni?
I'm an academic at the University of Southern Queensland. I teach predominantly non-Indigenous students, Indigenous studies for their teacher training awards.
Steve, there is some talk or a rumour, a whisper that the Nigger Brown Stand that you've been involved with in, you've been involved in a campaign trying to get the word nigger removed from the Nigger Brown Stand in Toowoomba. Now, there's some word that this stand may be demolished. What do you know about this?
Well, about 2 weeks before the elections, the Queensland elections, the chairman of the Sports Ground Trust, unbeknown to me, made a public announcement that his organisation had submitted, or was going to submit an application to the government for funding to redevelop the facilities at the Athletic Oval, including the stand in question. And there was suggestion, or he alluded to the fact that it may involve naming rights to the new sign. And so straight away the media rang me and asked what was going on, and I said, I didn't know anything, it's the first time I've heard about it. And they said, well, they're putting in an application, so it may be some time before the application is considered. And then a week later, the Deputy Premier, Anna Bligh, made an announcement when she was campaigning in Toowoomba that she was going to, or that the government was going to allocate $2 million if they got re-elected for the redevelopment. So in the space of a week, the application was done and approved in principle. So I wasn't involved in any of the discussions. The media rang me again, and all I can think of, Tiger, is that perhaps they see that the sign is now outdated. Perhaps I have been successful in raising the awareness of the broader community that that term is no longer acceptable, and perhaps it's a way of them bringing down the sign without conceding defeat to me. I think it's all about white power, white control again. I think they want to do it on their terms without appearing to surrender to my demands.
Yes, that was going to be you've answered my next question, which was along those lines. Do you think this is just a way of these fellas actually coming to their senses, the authorities, the establishment, coming to their senses and realising it's a little bit outdated and what have you? So whatever the reason, Steve, you've certainly played a role in highlighting this and making people aware and bringing it to the attention of everybody in this country and probably other communities across the universe.
Well, yes, thanks, Tiger. Look, I've been at this since 1999, and I've been the subject of a lot of ridicule, both by the broader community, the white community, and also by a lot of Aboriginal people who thought I was stirring up trouble and creating unease with their white friends in Toowoomba. And I don't think anybody thought they were ready for a debate as controversial as one I was entering into the public arena. So the continued battle by me in the courts has demonstrated to the broader community that, look, this wasn't an issue that was just going to go away. I mean, I kept at it and at it. But I'm still having the problem, though, Tiger, although this sign will come down, the Tormore Sports Ground Trust is still pursuing me in the courts. They want to bankrupt me because I'm refusing to pay the legal cost of a award against me by the High Court of Australia. And that's considerable cost that I would have to bear if I was to pay that. So we have a very, very unusual and strange situation where the sign may well come down, but I may become bankrupt because I refuse to pay the legal costs of the other parties who took me right through all the domestic courts in Australia.
That's a big price to pay.
It's a price I'm prepared to pay, mate. Look, if it means I'm going to be a bankrupt for 5 years and surrender my passport and have no control of my finance, well, I'm prepared to do that. But I would like to think that the government will see fit to, as the owner of the Oval, I mean, the organisation in Toowoomba, just a trustees of the for the government to manage the Oval. So I would like to think that the Beattie government would be big enough to concede that public opinion has turned against them and just waiver the cost that's already been incurred in the domestic courts. Minding you, I've already had a victory on the international level, the United Nations. They've supported me and asked the state to remove the offending word "nigger" from the sign. But you know, they're playing. They're being a bit precious with their own domestic courts and enforcing this the legal cost against me.
What could members of the public do to support your hopes that the state government may make a decision to waiver that cost? Well, what could people outside of think? Well, yeah, this place, that's a reasonable request, and I'd like to do something. What could people in the members of the public do?
Well, I've never ever sought financial assistance from anyone, Tiger. I thought it was a fair request for me to make, given that there's no other public signs in the world with the word "nigger" on it. I thought it was a fair and reasonable request to make. And given that the government wastes so much money nowadays, I mean, their ministers fly overseas first class, you know, every week. I mean, they're wasting fortune just travelling and abusing taxpayers' money. So if in this instance they're prepared to pay $2 million to redevelop the sign, develop the stand, which in effect gets rid of the sign, why can't they waive the cost to fall in line with the rest of the world? Why do they need to have the satisfaction of bankrupting a person who's campaigned to bring about this this $2 million grant to the trust? I think it would be very mean-spirited on their part if they were to insist on me meeting the costs. I don't have the resources to do that. I mean, you know, I have a house and a car and children going to school, so, you know, we're all going to be impacted upon by a decision. I mean, as you also know, I've recently been announced the NATO Person of the Year. I have responsibilities under that. I'm flying down to Sydney on Thursday. I may well win my second Deadly Award for Outstanding Achievement in Literature. So I'm plugging away and making my own little contribution to society, and this very act that they may do can jeopardise and curtail all future endeavours by myself.
Well, when you talk about taxpayers' money in the state government, they just offered, only in the last couple of weeks, a state funeral for Steve Irwin, and Steve's family said, no, we don't thank you very much, but no thanks, we're pretty well right. Now, that would cost, that may be equivalent to the cost of, to these legal costs. So they can do these things, as you and I both well know. They can make decisions to spend taxpayers' money as they wish. But, I mean, my question basically is, could people get on the email? Could they write a letter? Could they send some sort of message to Beattie? What could members of the public do?
I'd love all your listeners. I know there's a lot. You've got a very large loyal listener base around Brisbane and around South East Queensland. I would like them to lobby, to send emails into the Premier, and also to the Deputy Premier, Anna Bligh. She's a member for South Brisbane, I believe. And just tell them that, look, you know, if you're going down this path of allocating $2 million, go an extra step and waive the legal costs, because at the end of the day, the costs are only borne by the state anyway.
Yeah.
It's not going to go back into any improvements on the Oval, I just think that would be fair and reasonable, and I would like like your listeners to do that if they feel so inclined.
We're talking to Steve Hagan about what he says, white power, and people caught up with power. What are your thoughts there on that one? Not a bad little play on words, Steve.
Yeah, look, I think people need to be aware that it's all about power and privilege. I use the term white power and white privilege. It's certainly not a derogatory terminology. It's an issue or term that I'm experiencing a lot in my academic work, and that is to identify the abuse of positions to make arbitrary decisions that affect Aboriginal and Islander people on a daily basis, and their draconian issues and draconian policies that they're implementing and impacting on our people every day.
That's probably one of the spin-offs of this program. We have a lot of non-Indigenous listeners as well to this station. But those that listen to this program, they're coming to terms, they're being challenged, they're being confronted with this, with terminology that they're very unfamiliar with. White power, white blindness, and this sort of stuff. And it's certainly, we want them to keep an open mind and don't sort of shut down this sort of stuff, Steve. It's important that they can broaden their own horizons and understand more about the system from an Indigenous perspective that they get out of this program.
Well, as you know, history is written by the victors. I mean, the people who conquer the world, they're the ones who write history. And it's only in recent years that we've been able to get a lot of our own Indigenous historians and authors writing from their perspectives. And our perspective is quite different to non-Indigenous perspectives. And I would like your listeners, your non-Indigenous listeners, to engage with us in the robust debate that's being held all around the place, at dining room tables, at barbecues in the backyard. If they can educate themselves, I mean, knowledge is power. If they can find out the real truth and meaning behind native title and reconciliation and stolen generation and
the real history of this country,
the real history of this country, the colonisation, then they'd be in a far better position to argue in a unbiased way with maybe some of the redneck relatives in the backyard to say, look, hang on, this is not right. This is what really happened. Let's get a bit of perspective on this.
Steve, what we're on about is truth and honesty, really, isn't it? I mean, when you look at the recording of history and the writing up of anything around at all, and you look at it and question, is this the truth? What we as Indigenous people are on about is the truth.
Yeah, absolutely, Tiger. I teach young students straight from year 12 and some mature age students who want to be school teachers. These are the people who are the future educators of our children. And, mate, they've gone through 12 years without learning anything about Indigenous history. They haven't heard of anything about the real issues surrounding colonisation. I mean, they are very ignorant, and I fear for the next generation of kids who these people teach, because they haven't got the foggiest idea.
So, Steve, you're saying that things haven't really changed all that much since you and I went to school, and probably our parents, in the way that what's being taught in classes regarding the history of this country.
Well, yeah, absolutely. When these students have 15 weeks with me in my program, they're actually shocked and horrified that they weren't taught these things. A lot of these young white students do want to learn. I tell them, I said, don't get complacent. You're all not going to end up in Toowoomba or Richmond as your first choice school. You're going to be going to remote and difficult schools, particularly the young single white males. They're going to be going up to Warrabindu and Yarrabah and Cowan and a lot of single young white girls will be going to a lot of those places too. So if they have got to put in 1 or 2 years in some of these so-called hardship postings, they better get themselves a bit educated before they make a fool of themselves in the school system.
Mm.
And look, they're really good. Credit to these young students. You get a couple of little rednecks in the room who try to upstage all the time, but they don't last very long. But on the whole, the students, they're hungry for information because they weren't provided with that in the schools.
All right. Now, look, we've just had a recent state election. There was no real opposition. It wasn't a matter of if the Labor Party won. It was a matter of no opposition, and of course they'd be elected back into power. But in that, as a result of that, now Beattie has come out and made the statement that has made Aboriginal Affairs brought under the umbrella of the Department of Community Services, and I had the Minister on air yesterday talking about that, Warren Pitt, being the Minister for Department of Communities and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs. What are your thoughts on this move?
Absolute insult. I mean, back when ATSIC was abolished, I mean, you know, we've seen it all now. I mean, the government had no problem, you know, back then of introducing the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Amendment Bill in 2004 in the Parliament, because Mark Latham himself, who was then the opposition leader, said that if he was elected, he'd abolish ATSIC. So Howard had no problem rushing it through both houses. And we sat back and said, wow, at least we've got the you know, all the other states and territories governed by Labor politicians. And then a couple of weeks ago, we saw in the Northern Territory where they repealed the Northern Territory Land Rights Act. And then the first decision I saw on the paper on the Monday after the election was Peter Biddy's announcing he was going to abolish the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. He says that it would be better and more effective if it was mainstream. So I don't know. I don't know much about this Biddy character. I mean, he's got this is his fourth term. He's got an overwhelming majority of seats in the House. They've only got one House nowadays. I was hoping that he would be a forward thinker and would start to invest a lot of our GST money into Aboriginal programs, fixing up the problems around the state. Not only the Palm Islands and Warrabinda, but, you know, Brisbane and Toowoomba, all the areas where our people are suffering, are continuing to experience, you know, all these abysmal, the diabolical issues regarding health, housing, employment, income creation, all that. I thought Biddy would have a fair dinkum go and say, okay, I may have been a bit bad with black affairs in the past, but I'm going to leave after this term, and at least people won't be able to criticise me about my contribution to Indigenous affairs. Mate, he'll be remembered for the Premier who did the least for Indigenous people. And just a reminder to your listeners, Tiger, and it pains me to say this, but the last full Department of Aboriginal Affairs was run under the National Party when we had Bob Catter as the Minister. You might remember back in those old days.
Certainly do.
And at least Bob Catter, he went and sat down with the Murrays and he had a talk to them, and he fought hard for our programs in the House. And ever since then, mate, we've just been dismantled and dismantled right down to where we're nobodies.
Paddy Killoran was the director, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, I try not to repeat that name too often, but, yeah, but...
Didn't he make a name for himself?
Yeah.
Beattie's going down the same path.
But where are we going? Well, I mean, I'm writing an article for the next Courier Mail, and I'm going to talk about this whole issue of leadership and where do we go and what sort of elected representation do we have around the country. Because the federal government that has appointed the National Indigenous Council, which are made up of 10 nominated people. So, mate, we don't have any voice at all. I mean, who do you see on TV nowadays if they want to complain or talk about Indigenous issues? I see Brother Sammy there, Watson, on TV a lot, but we don't see, unless you're in the southeast corner, you don't see him around the state. So issues are not being addressed by elected representatives around the state on Indigenous issues. So I don't know where we are, brother. It's a state of chaos now.
It's
that
a worry.
It's a real worry, Tiger, because what happens is we go back to the old mission days where you got incompetent white bureaucrats making decisions about our future, sitting in their high-paid jobs in the Department of Communities there.
That's the other question that begs to be asked, and it was remiss of me not to ask it yesterday when I had the Minister on the program. But who will be giving advice? Where's he going to go for his advice? Now, I had Vince Munderby, the Mayor of Yarrabah, yep, was on also yesterday, and he was saying, you know, well, Warren Pitt does have some degree of understanding, something you can't say about the former minister, a bloke by the name of John McKell, who probably did that much. He will be easily forgotten, or did that little. He'd be very easily forgotten, his contribution towards Indigenous affairs in the state.
It doesn't matter anything, mate. I mean, if Warren Pitt doesn't have a high profile in the state parliament, you know, he will not get programmed through unless it's endorsed by the Premier. He's a one-man band, this guy. I mean, he's the guy. If he places a priority on anything, he'll run it through. So the fact that they've dismantled it and done that means that irrespective of how committed Warren Pitt is to the Indigenous cause, it's a big hurdle for him to get over, mate, because he's got to service all his other portfolios within that one ministry.
That's right.
And to do justice with the other ones. And I bet you $1 million, when you read the title of his portfolio, Indigenous Affairs will be right at the end of it.
On the bottom of the list.
Like we were with the federal government, I'd be on multicultural affairs. We're right down the back, mate. We're right down the back of all these different ministers, so they won't be taking Indigenous Affairs very seriously.
Steve, now this multicultural debate that's taken place, mate, I see on page 3 of the Courier Mail, they've got a suggested 10 questions, and I'll just pick a couple of these, but my question is, I think they'd be chasing a lot of white fellas out of this country if they put these sort of questions to people. In what corner of the Australian flag is the Union Jack? Who was Australia's first Prime Minister? Now, some of those students you teach, you're an academic.
Yeah.
How many of them would be able to give you answer to that?
They wouldn't. Some of the mature age students might know it, but no, mate, they don't know that sort of thing.
And in which state is Birdsville? Would somebody in the Territory or Cape York or Victoria, South Australia, know where Birdsville is?
How important
is it?
Just that question, mate. You go to Melbourne and Sydney, where you go down Logan Street or Balmain, where they're very yuppie areas. They don't care, mate.
That's right.
I mean, the only places in Australia are Melbourne and Sydney. They fly between those cities
and
do business. They don't care where Birdsville is.
What about this one? On what date did Australia become a federation?
They don't care. As long as they're making their millions and getting their tax break, they don't care. Well, that sort of thing.
But a lot of people just don't know that. And why should they? It's just not relevant.
Nah,
it is not relevant to Australians, let alone. But anyway, what are your thoughts?
Well, white Australia policy, as you know, traced back to the 1950s, and that was, really about. They get rid of these industrious Chinese diggers in the gold fields. Then later on, they introduced the Immigration Restriction Act in 1901 because of the Pacific Islanders. The Kanakas were brought over here, and white people thought they were going to be done away with their jobs, you know. So you can go right back to that era when there was really strong racist overtones in government policy and legislation. But now, just when you think people are supposed to be more enlightened, they're taking it back to those dark old ages again, mate, the dark years, you know. It really worries me that after, 9/11, that everything's changed. I mean, the government's been allowed to disseminate all this fear within the community about everything to do with immigration. And the public is just accepting it. They're just copying it on the chin saying, yeah, do that. We'll let you get away with it. And, mate, I don't know what we're leaving for the next generation of kids are coming through. I don't know what sort of society we're going to leave for them.
It's certainly a worry. Listen, mate, you've got to go to a meeting. I've got to go to the news very soon. It's good to have you join me this morning for your comments. We need to hear as diverse an opinions as we can, and it's great to have you contribute towards that.
Thanks, Tiger, and best wishes to all your listeners, mate.